All right, good afternoon, everyone. We have a special guest with us today. Ron is here. Steve is a pastor up in Indiana. Tell everyone where you pastor.
I'm the pastor of First Baptist Church in Warsaw, Indiana.
And Steve worked for our academy back when, Steve? How far back are we going?
2003, 2004. Yep,
as a started. English teacher?
English teacher and athletic director and...
Athletic? No way.
Yeah, for a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you get fired?
What is athletic about you? I didn't know that.
He's a soccer
you
don't, guy.
You just have to be able to direct it.
Play anything. Oh my goodness, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
And then you
for
also...
A full year.
You also were youth pastor, right?
Yep, after the academy. Yeah.
Okay.
So I was full time at the academy for a year, then youth pastor for 4 years. Yep. So
I'm over.
So you experienced a call to preach during that transition, or what do you think happened?
I think that I became unafraid of my call to preach.
Okay.
During that transition, I think I did a lot of work in chapel and things like that, and I just knew this is where I want to be. I want to be doing this, and yep. So
and then from there, you went to Brockton, Mass. As a church planner.
Yep.
And you were a church planner for how long?
5 years there as well. Yep.
Wow. And now you're in Warsaw.
Yep.
And tell us a little bit about your congregation.
Well, we are. Let's see. Warsaw is a town of about 20,000 people. If you include a little village named Winona Lake, which it kind of envelops it, so we count that. And we got a college and seminary really close by, so we have usually a pretty biblically literate congregation, folks, and a lot of medical. Engineer type.
What kind
folks.
Of Baptist are you?
I am. What kind of Baptist am I?
Yeah, is that it general?
We are unaffiliated. We are independent.
Okay.
There have been a couple of times. The church was founded in 1851. no. And Jack's trying to get me off the topic over here. I won't fall for it.
He prefers Dr. Farmer, by the way.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
I don't think I say that. Anyhow.
wow. Well, he didn't have the diploma on his wall yet.
We go way back.
Yeah, too far. And so, too far for that. So anyhow, we're unaffiliated. We in the 170-year history, I think it's been affiliated twice. But now the Constitution is militantly. I don't know what happened. I'm not sure. But it's like,
but
we're never doing that again.
Okay, yeah, so you're not affiliated.
We
right.
are independent. Yeah.
But not Indy Fundy.
No. No.
What translation do you use?
I preach from the ESV.
Oh, you're not Indy Fundy.
No.
I don't even, you don't even wear a suit on Sundays, do you?
No, yeah. I don't. I wear a tie every
you're
once
You're more
in a
Indy
while.
Fundy than he is.
Do you wear jeans?
No, I don't. I don't.
Okay, so there's still a little hope. Right?
I think if I thought that there was that it would be okay, I probably would. But since I've never tested those waters, I don't care that much. So,
all right. So we have an article and a video. The article is from a. Let's see. I was reading what he was. It says Knox Thames is a former special advisor. Man, that's a special advisor, man. Special advisor for the religious minorities at the U.S. Department of State, serving in both the Obama and Trump administrations. So there's our article. And the heading is, Corona Church Closures Are Not Persecution. Amid mounting allusions to persecution because of the closure of churches on health grounds due to the pandemic, I want to provide some respective perspective on my fellow American, or for my fellow American Christians, all right? I've worked for my 20-year career in international religious freedom, meeting persecuted Christians from around the world. I've heard their stories, seen their tears and wounds, lost friends. From those encounters, I've learned persecution is intense and it is violence. So his argument is that it is not persecution that we're going through, right? All right, now Johnny Mack just recently put out a video, October 7th, so that's yesterday, and it's 3 minutes and 42 seconds, and it, let me back it up, and it has a, not a opposing view, but it does take a different edge to it. So let's listen to this first, and then we'll finish the article.
Potential. Hi, I'm John MacArthur, and I am pastor of Grace Community Church,
right here in Los Angeles, and I have been for over half a century. This is a church committed to the bedrock conviction that the Bible is the Word of God, and we, in obedience to that Word, have met together every Sunday for all these years. We have been protected by our government. We've been given freedom to do that. Today's current crop of politicians are trampling on the Constitution and on the resolve of citizens to demand their rights under the pressure of a manufactured fear. The reality is that the COVID data just doesn't match the government's COVID narrative. Here in the state of California, we have 40 million people. The people that have COVID now are 1/100th of 1%, 0.001. You have a 99.999 chance to survive COVID. It's just not what they're saying it is. That absolutely does not warrant shutting down anything, but especially absurdly and arbitrarily, churches that have a special protection from the Constitution. Oh, and at the same time, leaving open abortion clinics, strip clubs, and marijuana dispensaries. And by the way, the health department is on record as saying they are going to allow riots and protests without regard for the mandated health and safety ordinances. This is obviously targeted discrimination. Leftists and secular government officials have no tolerance for biblical Christianity, so they're using COVID as an excuse to shut us down. We have to stand firm on the reality that the church is essential. The most meaningful, transformative, exemplary lives in a community all come together in the church. That's been our impact on the city of Los Angeles. For 20 weeks, we had no ministry to children, young people, college students, young adults, families, no weddings, no funerals, no ministry to our precious disabled people, and no opportunity to make calls in the hospital to those who were sick. I started preaching to an empty auditorium, and after a few weeks, our people started coming back because they didn't believe the narrative the local government and media were giving them. Week by week, more people came until finally we had about 7,000 people gathering for worship. The church is the original protester. We go back to the Protestant Reformation 500 years ago when the government was trying to dictate to the church how it should worship. This is a watershed moment in America. We have been granted by God the freedom to meet as a church, and that is protected by the Constitution. We need to be the church, not only because we're free to be the church, but because we're commanded to be the church by the Lord Jesus Christ, the head of the church. This is a time of all times to meet as the church. Open your church. The church is essential.
Okay, thoughts on the video before we get into the article?
Well done. I mean, it's definitely, you know, a perspective that I don't think people are listening to look at the narrative versus the data. I mean, we have here locally inside Berean, but I don't think the American church has been watching the two and trying to reconcile what is being said versus what the data shows.
Now, did you guys go through it? Because we had basically the same thing happen here, obviously on a much, much smaller scale. But I was preaching to an empty auditorium. And then, you know, there was several families that were absolutely committed. I don't think they missed any Sundays except for on Easter Sunday. We were obnoxious about it because we knew that there would be greater scrutiny on the church on that particular Sunday. What about up in Warsaw? How did y'all work through that? Did you have no services? Did you have online services? What'd you do?
Well, we got the stay-at-home order, and when we realized that it was going to, you know, drastically affect our worship services, we geared up for live streaming. We weren't live streaming our services before that, but we didn't miss a beat as far as taking a Sunday off from everything. So thankfully, we were able to start live streaming right away.
Okay.
And then as soon as we were able to, because obviously every state handles their reopening differently. Indiana was one of the more aggressive reopening states, and it was also
the churches were allowed to basically use their own discretion. The wording was, this is what we advise you to do, this is what we would like you to do, but we're not. And so it was totally different wording than they were using with restaurants and with bars and with retail and everything. So we have the opposite perspective that John MacArthur has. I mean, we were actually given more freedom than the businesses around us, so to use our own discretion.
And that's Indiana versus California.
Absolutely.
Is there really much difference between Indiana and California? I can't imagine that there
just
is.
Just a little.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. Now, are you in a red state?
Yeah. Yep. Red.
Red, purple, or red?
No, red. We're not a swing state. We're just red. Yep.
Red. And California's blue?
Pretty blue, yeah.
Pretty blue? Pretty solid blue.
It's a pretty color blue. It's a blue like Steve's shirt.
Yep.
I find it amusing that Christians aren't getting that they're not making the connections. That I would just had lunch with four guys in my office, and one in particular was just oblivious to the difference in these public policies that are being enacted, and they just seem to not see it. Like, you know, put these glasses on. You're obviously blind, kind of a deal. So let's get into the article and see if this guy has anything worth learning.
Pastor, before we move on, I do have a question. It was something that was brought up in the video. Can we compare, or honestly, would you guys compare the Reformation to what we're facing today? I mean, would we go that far? I don't have an answer. I wanted to ask
a lowercase R or a mini Reformation or...
Well, he kind of name-dropped Luther.
You mean battling the church? You mean battling the state for the church freedom? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that was kind of the comparison
not,
he used.
Because the Reformation was over a period of years. I mean, probably 150 good solid years where people were still killing each other over this really hot-button issue, right?
Yeah, maybe if you're on the wrong side of it, you died.
Right.
Here you get fined.
Yeah, so it's I would
different.
Say no.
It's not the same. He's used the watershed.
Yeah, I mean, there was
moment.
A lot
this
of beheadings and hangings and being burnt at the stakings.
Burnt at the stakings.
Luther was kept alive by France's rebellion against Charles V. The pushback that was constantly going on over who should be the Holy Roman Emperor, and Charles V had become more on the defensive point of protecting his political territory and reign, so he couldn't wholesale pursue Luther when he had been protected by the German nobles and hid away as I can't remember what knight they named him for a while when he was hiding in seclusion and everything else. They didn't have the time to hunt him because he was too busy worrying about the possibility of a war and handling these rebellious states, and that's what really allowed the Reformation to have an impetus of survival, because in that time Luther was able to write prolifically and put stuff out there in such a way that it carried it forward. I think it was just a perfect timing of God's protection that there was a political upheaval at the same time as there was a religious one.
So you have to roll your eyes a little bit when John MacArthur compares himself and what he's going through to that. I mean, I understand what he's trying to say, but I think there might have been a little bit of hyperbole there.
Do you think you'd feel a little differently if it was your church that was being fined $5,000 every service?
No, I still wouldn't have the whatever it is audacity to compare myself to
intestinal
Martin Luther. Yeah, so, but again, I'm in Indiana and not California, so obviously.
Perhaps the issues are the same. I mean, perhaps it's the same issue we're dealing with, but I think to the level to which people are dying and being, you know, affected, probably not.
And he's not being stopped from preaching the gospel. He can preach the gospel. He just can't do it to a live, in-person audience.
Or he could and pay the fines if he wanted to as well.
Right, yeah. But, I mean, so you know, Luther and his cronies were in trouble for what they were saying, not who they were saying it to. Or even the means with which they were delivering it. So it just is different.
And I think the video and the article, which we haven't gotten into yet, cause us to have an underlying question of, is discrimination persecution? Discrimination is occurring in a lot of the political decisions. But can we say that discrimination, is it persecution?
Well, I think we need to really be careful here, because if we go down the road and say, no, it's not, then that would also argue then that the discrimination that occurs against African Americans is not a form of persecution either, because I don't think you can have it both ways. I don't think you can say that the discrimination perpetrated against African Americans as a whole is not persecution or is persecution, but when the church is discriminated against, it's not persecution.
And we have to be careful on the flip side of that of saying that it is, because if we go down that road, then the LGBTQ, if you say you can't work here if you're a homosexual, they're going to claim, well, you know, you say it's persecution on this end of this discrimination, because obviously we believe in some sort of discrimination. We believe that we are going to use a set of rules to say whether you can be in fellowship with us, whether you can work here. You know, but that's also just in general the way that the workplace normally is. I mean, they're pretty discriminatory when it comes to heart surgeons over at Cape Fear Valley. Like, if you haven't had any heart surgery experience, you probably aren't going to get the job. Is that persecution? No.
Is it discrimination?
Yes.
Or is it qualifications?
Well, there's a good discussion too. Perhaps he gives some, you know, some.
Yeah, I'm not going all the way down that road, because obviously to be discriminating is not the same thing as discrimination. You know, so I'm going to be discriminating with the person I marry. That doesn't mean I'm discriminating against all the females that I chose not to marry. So there's clearly a distinction here. But do we only get concerned because, you know, we're saying, MacArthur, you're going a little bit overboard. It's not a watershed moment. You're not really being persecuted against, which is what the article is going to argue for. So then does that mean that we just become apathetic?
Or at what point in time does it cross over? Does the discriminating against, that's not complete discrimination, at what point does it cross the boundary and become persecution?
Therefore, he says, I hope Americans will set the term persecution aside so it doesn't lose its intensity and veracity. Brian?
The United States is one of the most open and liberal countries for freedom of religion and belief. From our first settlers seeking freedom to practice their faith, to our founding values starting with the First Amendment and consequent laws, and now a long-running string of Supreme Court victories, Americans of all faiths and no faith have become accustomed to ever-expanding religious liberties. It's part of American exceptionalism. And this exceptionalism carries over into how our country promotes and protects religious freedom and freedom for an internet and freedom
all.
For all. Sorry, I was at the stable. Internationally. During my time at the State Department under both Obama and Trump administrations, we helped carry this out, preaching the values of religious liberty as good as social good, as well as confronting persecutors. The U.S. is the foremost advocate internationally, full stop. Persecuted people of all faiths pray for our intervention and desire to flee to our shores. With the pandemic, it's been unsettling for Americans to see local and state governments direct the closure of churches, as well as synagogues, mosques, and temples, for health reasons. It's not something most of us have experienced before. However, I know many churches have found innovative new ways to gather virtually or outdoors, for Sunday worship or fellowship. My church is no exception. It's better than nothing, and we benefit from our communities of faith during these challenging times. While the temporary closures are jarring for Americans, foreign governments permanently shut down places of worship all the time. Sadly, it is not unusual, but common. Persecution levels are at all-time highs worldwide, with more than three-quarters of the global community facing severe limitations on the free practice of faith. Consequently, Christians of every denomination, people of other traditions, and individuals practicing no faith face persecution every day for what they believe. In my diplomatic work, I've seen churches shuttered and worship criminalized. My bookshelf holds pieces of churches and mosques and synagogues torn down by authoritarian governments. Based on these experiences, I believe American Christians would be wise to avoid labeling the current situation as persecution for three reasons.
All right, so before we get into the reasons, do we agree with this train of thought?
I think that last paragraph for sure, because I think of like China or North Korea, and we're not to that point. That's not the same level of persecution by no means.
His premise is spot on. The more you use the word persecution, the less meaningful it is.
Okay.
So, and just the kind of conversation we had before we jumped into this much of the article, I mean, the parallel between the Reformation and what's going on in California, for example, I mean, we just said that, no, it's not the same. I would say that Luther could define his situation as being persecuted.
But I'm also willing to say that it's worse for John MacArthur than it is here in Fayetteville.
Yes.
And that there is a bigger tug of war going on between the government and those religious freedoms going on in California than they are in North Carolina.
Yep.
And that, you know, he, like, because it's going on to him, and because he sees that, he's going to have a different perspective of this. He's going to be way on the spectrum of it's coming very soon, and we have a tendency to become like, well, we don't really believe it's coming in our country because we don't see it in our locale. And I think that's the way normally people are. If you don't see a lot of African Americans in your community being treated poorly, then you have this narrative and belief that, you know, racism doesn't exist. But if you grow up in a place where you see it every day, then you're going to have the understanding that it does. And I think that we're tempted to look at our current bubble. I mean, it's the same way with evangelism for me. I don't know a lot of unsaved people just because of where I work, and you know, and so you know, it's really difficult sometimes to believe what other people tell you about their viewpoint because you just don't see it in your world.
Yeah, perception's reality. What I perceive of the world around me becomes my reality.
All right, let's go. The first significant
difference is motive. From what I've observed, most state and local officials are searching in good faith for at least bad options during these uncertain times. For sure, there are some with anti-religion or anti-Christian agenda. I've seen frustrating decisions that appear inconsistent or arbitrary. But if their decisions are unconstitutional, our judicial system provides strong remedies. Most public servants are trying their level to best balance civil rights against concerns about public health, all with imperfect information while under a microscope in an unprecedented situation. A second difference is duration. When churches are closed for health reasons, the move is temporary until conditions improve. When local officials make these decisions, our faith isn't banned or made illegal. In fact, I've seen officials encourage worship just online. In many jurisdictions, you can still gather in different ways or in smaller groups without consequence. Third, most importantly, the biggest difference is that persecution is brutal and violent. Hebrews 11:35-37 gives a vivid example of the persecution of the early church, which believers faced for centuries. In modern times, here are some examples I've grappled with. Persecution is the imprisoning of Christians because they are Christians, as Pastor Andrew Brunson was in Turkey, or converts now in Iran. Persecution is the sudden closing of or commando-like police raids upon your church, as in the former Soviet Union. Persecution is bulldozing churches to the ground, as today in China and not too long ago in Sudan. Persecution is when ISIS attempted genocide against Yazidis and Christians, or the genocide of the army of Burma or Myanmar is committing now against the Rohingya Muslims. Persecution is China's unrelenting assault on Tibetan Buddhist and Uyghur Muslims. Persecution is the murder of Christians for their faith, like when Pakistani Taliban assassinated my friend Shabazz Bhatti for his defense of Christians and other religious minorities. Persecution is public flogging in Saudi Arabia for merely questioning on the internet their Salafist orientation. Persecution is the kidnapping, forced conversion, and rape of Hindu and Christian girls in Pakistan with no recourse for the family. Based on these examples, American Christians should be very careful about labeling our current situation as persecution. There is a continuum from administrative limitations to outright persecution. If there are problems, Americans of faith can petition the courts and fight like hell through any number of pro bono groups well-situated to argue their case. Or, American believers can ask their elected representatives to change laws. But these strong tools are often unavailable in other countries.
All right, that's good. That's good. So he's making his point real well. If you're not getting beat over the head by a baseball bat, then you don't have anything to talk about in America.
Yep.
I mean, that's the essence of it. So let's all just shut up and stop tweeting and stop complaining and thank God that we're not in one of those other companies.
I'm going to throw out a term that's real popular right now. Okay, I get that. And I'll play devil's advocate. I get that. But don't we need to flatten the curve? Don't we need to make sure we don't get there? And if we wait until that point, then it's going to really be almost the battle's lost.
So then it might be a watershed moment.
So we've already said that we would not feel comfortable comparing the current situation to that of the Reformation.
Those guys said that.
Okay.
Right.
Those who have been
pointed
reported
at me, by the way. Yes.
All right. What about
I'll sit on this side.
What about the search for religious freedom that would lead to the founding of our nation? Not necessarily the you're being persecuted completely and thrown in jail and killed, but the we're not as friendly toward the way you want to practice religion because of our state church. Therefore, they go looking. Would we compare it to that situation where it's no, you're not at risk of being put to death over this, but we're not friendly with you.
Well, I think what Steve said is important to point out again, and that is these situations with the current pandemic are not focused on what you're saying. It's your presence in saying it. And so what the talk show hosts and whatever are saying is, yes, the alarmists throwing up their hands saying, yes, that's true, but it's also getting us conditioned to being shut down for whenever the government says it's time to shut down. Now, I can't prove that. I can't prove that if you're going to be willing to shut down for a health reason, therefore you're going to be willing to shut down because you're preaching against homosexuality. I can't prove that because I don't really totally believe it. I believe that people are thinking enough that they're going to say, no, we're not going to give up on truth. You're not going to shut us down for truth in America. We'll shut down for the pandemic because we kind of want to do the best thing for everybody. But if you come in here and tell us shut down because we're preaching now hate speech because we say the Bible says a view on homosexuality, then we're going to keep preaching and you're going to have to drag us off to prison.
So this is what popped in my head as you were saying that, Jonathan, is this article petitions the fact, it's not that you can't preach and have church, just do so virtually. And so I almost wonder if there are not some politically thinking, well, they won't, if we try to shut them down, we know they'll go kicking and screaming this way. But if we can get them to go primarily digitally, then we can institute whatever is necessary to then censor it or shut it down based upon what. Because it's a whole lot easier to filter through data flowing through the internet than it is to police live conversation happening in a church all across America.
Sure, and I mean, if you've got a conspiratorial mind, you can certainly see how that forcing it into the digital realm gives them the better chance to listen to key phrases and key words that are going on. And
well, I would argue it's
shut
even,
it down.
Right, it's even more than that, the key phrases. I mean, who in this room has the ability to make sure that you can broadcast something?
Mark Zuckerberg.
Exactly, yeah. So, right? I mean, if you run way out there to this edge of, of insanity and say, you know, it's because it's possible. I mean, we have to recognize that it is possible that they would be able then to have the ability to shut down all the internet or whatever.
Right.
I mean, it sounds impossible, but it's possible.
It's very possible. It's not the most wild idea in the world. I don't have any ability to make something get uploaded. I don't have a radio broadcast antenna in my backyard that's in my backyard, and you can't shut it down. I am relying on Facebook. I am relying on Sermon Audio. I am relying on the internet. I don't have a means of... I don't have a blowhorn or what's that thing?
Bullhorn
or what you're holding. That's the internet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we see right now that it's controlled by Google. Like the algorithms. We have no idea the degree to which the algorithms are being manipulated by Google. Because every algorithm that determines what you get when you put a word in has been programmed. Somebody's programming it in some form or fashion.
Yeah. Prager University's dealing with the censorship of their stuff now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you're censorship persecution.
I'm on board with agreeing with the author that I think the word persecution is overkill. I would want to go more in the direction of there are state governments that are being very unfriendly towards churches and the respect of the separation of church and state and the freedom to worship.
I think it should be a giant wake-up call. That's what I think it should be. I think it should just be a huge... We don't have to classify it with persecution. We can put a lowercase p in front of it. We can say mild persecution. We can say pre-persecution in some way. But I do think that...
Glide path?
What?
That this is kind of a glide
path. Of course it's a glide path.
So
of course it is.
If we went around this room and we said, Nate, what...
Why'd you have to start with me?
Yes.
So we're going to ask this question.
Because you're going to go plant a church, brother, and you're going to have to answer these questions.
If we ask around this room, what do you think that the chances that the next Supreme Court will overturn Roe versus Wade, give it a percentage, what would you say it was the likelihood of that happening would be?
30%. Very low.
I'd put it at 0%.
With Amy Berry...
Yeah, with a conservative court, if we get a totally conservative court, you know, I mean...
5-4 justices is what we're saying. John Roberts would be number 6.
Just in the land of America...
In the next 10 years.
In the next 10 years. Percentage, a likelihood.
30%.
Low number, right?
Something like that.
Well, you know that right now, the pro-death people... I'm not going to even use their term.
Right.
The pro-death people... are in a frenzy, turmoil, jumping up and down, just like we would on these issues, saying, hey, the world's going to end, it's coming. You know, if you let, you know, this court forward.
Your point is so well taken, I think, John, because they're more concerned about it than we are.
Right.
They're more concerned about losing Roe versus Wade and their right to abort babies than we are about losing our right to... broadcast.
And I'm perhaps maybe more cynical in the room. I think it's a lower chance. I just don't think that once we've gone
down... How'd you get lower than my 0%?
I don't think... Oh, zero. I forgot. Zero. Yeah.
Like,
I don't think it's going to happen.
No,
in America, because we've got generations of too many selfish people now that they're not going to let it happen. But that said, they're really, really worked up about something that's probably not going to happen.
Suggesting we're just worked up about something that's not going
to happen. No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is...
We're not worked up about something that is probably going to happen.
Yeah, what I'm saying is they're trying to get ahead of it to make sure that this doesn't happen because their worldview...
And that's what Johnny Mike's trying to do.
Right. And they're saying, you know, this is important because if they take away abortion rights in America, this world is just going to be horrible. This is not going to be even a livable world. And I think that many, many Christians... aren't that even passionate enough about their faith and the potential to live in a world like that that they would get as upset.
What percentage of your congregations come back?
Like 80% now.
Yeah. Okay, so we're at 75% is basically what we've identified.
Yeah.
We're tracking all the numbers in comparison.
Yeah.
Last Sunday of the same year, we even the... Even the men's retreat,
our
right?
Our men's stakeout that we're having tomorrow night, we're at roughly 80%.
Right.
Maybe a little better.
So do you think that that 20% is never coming back, Steve?
No, I think that they will, as of right, asking me right now, if you ask me a couple months, I may have a gloomier outlook on it. But they're still giving, they're still commenting on the Facebook feed. They're still emailing here and there with prayer requests. They're still connected. Okay. So I think that they're going to come back. Yeah.
And what do you think the trigger is going to be to get people coming back?
That I don't know. I don't know, because we've had people trickle back in, and nothing is different. I mean, our numbers in our county have been basically, you know, our COVID numbers. I mean, they're basically what they've been for the last 2 or 3 months. Our county is really low. There's not a lot going on COVID wise. Their life hasn't changed that much. So I'm not sure. You know, I think just they're now kind of just seeing it. You know, it's probably time to come back. And I guess all of them will do that at some point, I'm hoping.
It's probably just going to be a dullness. It's worn off. It's no longer going to be talked about. And it's just going to go to, oh, wait. And then
that's kind of what's happening in our community. Our community isn't really reflecting most news narratives or whatever, however.
Yeah. Well, and like you said earlier, I mean, you're in a rather small town.
Right, and we're pretty. I mean, it's also incredibly socially and politically conservative. It's also pretty Bible belty in a lot of ways.
Highly educated.
Yeah, highly educated. A lot of middle class or upper middle class people. A lot of people they're going to be there for their lifers. You know, it's not a very transient community. So our relationship to COVID has always been. Not, you know, it doesn't reflect even some of the bigger cities around us in Indiana.
Jack, what do you think? What's the trigger going to be to get these people that, because I find it interesting that we had folks coming back and then for some reason they stopped coming back and now they're back into positions of isolation again. I can think of at least 5 families that had a coming back for several weeks and then like they got spooked or something. And especially with the mask became a really big deal, and we don't wear masks. Are you guys wearing masks?
No, that wouldn't be inaccurate.
Okay.
Yeah, we do have a mask mandate, but it is it's a toothless mask mandate. The way he phrased it is like he didn't even believe in it, the governor, and especially for churches. But most churches in our community are requiring masks. Or they're holding outdoor services. We're one of the few that aren't doing really either one of those. There's not a lot of masks in our church.
What are your thoughts, Jack? What's going to be the trigger to get? Is it the vaccine? Do you think?
I think it's a combination of things. Vaccine's definitely one. But we have plenty of anti-vaxxers out there that.
Yeah, that's what confuses me, Jack, is that.
So you have that piece playing out. We have, I think it's like anything, it's going to be the confidence level based upon what's happening in society. So as long as the narrative is scary, you're going to have an element out there. So what's going to happen is we're going to have a political shift.
So that the media stops the narrative?
Well, the elections will be over. And we will know which direction we're going to go. We're going to know. And for 4 years, they're going to they don't have to worry about leveraging certain things to create a hysteria for one direction or another, to create a political swing for voting and everything else. Narratives will shift. Other stories will become focused. This one may linger longer post-election. But the fact of the matter is the narrative is going to become toned down. It's going to become toned down in one direction or the other. And as it becomes toned down, I don't even care if it's a blue swing. At some point, the blue no longer has to be elected. Or the red no longer has to be elected. And they begin to then work a new narrative and opening up, allowing this, allowing that. they'll start to build more confidence in, see, we were right, this was the greatest thing, you guys elected us, showed you we could do it, now I can kind of move myself away from life and to another new groove of life or whatever, and people will begin to either buy in, say that was bogus or what have you, and they'll begin to move past where they're at. You're going to have a standard deviation of people that are never going to come back. They're never going to return to normal in themselves and everything else. You'll have people that are that were they were already marginalized.
5%, 3%?
It depends. Probably roughly about 2 to 3% that were just, they were already on the edge anyways and were looking for any excuse really not to be in church. And this has provided it. And then you're gonna have the ones that are going to be the late stragglers coming back. And it's going to take something to build confidence in them. And generally, it's going to have to be around them, people that they know and trust extremely well. So let's say that right now, 10% of our population, 20% of our population, what percentage of our population has had COVID? Okay, so take that percentage. The closer that becomes to 90, 95, 96% of our entire U.S. population has had it. With a 1% mortality, then these stragglers are going to feel more confident. Right now, everybody's hanging back going, when's the next outbreak? The White House has done nothing to help us in our COVID narrative. The most secure location on the in the United States has an outbreak, and they're the ones that are running around no mask. Crowding up in offices and everything else. That is not instilling confidence in the American people, especially when they have the best health care in the world. They're getting drugs that aren't even authorized to be used on the normal person in the United States. I mean, so you're I wouldn't be surprised if you see a backing off in who's attending at this point, especially the more people crowd together. And that's what it really is let's see if this spreads like wildfire. If it spreads like wildfire and everybody gets it, okay, well, most everybody's got it. Do we go back and expose ourselves to have it ourselves? Or do we hang out longer? Do we get the vaccine that comes in? It's really a matter of what do people see and perceive. And the more you crowd together, the more you put people into pews, the more that you put people into rooms, the more that you crowd people up and everything else, if somebody they know gets it and survives it, like had a normal cold, then they're going to be more confident to come back. The more they know people who are in ICU, the less likely they're going to come back. Because it really boils down to, it's like, how do you get people to come to your business? Word of mouth. That's the best form of advertising. Well, it's also the best form of advertising to encourage people to say, it's safe, come back out. Or, no, it's not safe, stay away. They come in, it looks overcrowded, they pull away again. And again, we're talking about a demographic piece. I mean, what's a standard bell curve that every business tells you about? Every product line, Dell operates off of it, Apple operates off of it, everybody operates off of it, and that's the idea of you have your early arrivers, which are roughly about 16% of the people. So you think about when you first started streaming and you said there was a small group of people that sat in the pews. 16%. That's in that one deviation. That's two standard deviations from the mean. Then you have roughly 34% of your people who will be, they're doing it, we're going to get in the next wave of it. Then you got 34% when you reach a tipping point, they get in it. Okay, and this 16%, it will divide into two groups. A very, very small group over here. So you're going to get about 14% that are going to come in if this group does extremely well in it. This 14% will come back and about 2% never will. And that's just the way it works. And it's what we're dealing with in the academy right now. You can't get them to come back. And our outbreak caused us to have a higher increase. Those five cases that we had caused us to have a higher increase of online enrollment than we started the school year with.
And yeah. Ironically, three of them were the part of the outbreak.
Correct.
Say that again.
We had five cases in our high school. Three of them are freshmen who are on the same basketball team in my Bible class, and those three students are among my digital students now. They're the ones who didn't come back.
And there could be a couple reasons for that. One would be fear, probably not. One could be the stigma of we're the ones who caused it or being blamed as the ones who caused it. The other piece of it is we want to keep playing basketball in these high-risk areas, so we're being socially conscious by not coming back because we're participating in high-risk things. I don't know which avenue those parents chose.
But
those are the most
based
three
upon
raceable.
My Bible class interaction is it depends on what's going on with mom and dad or whether or not I was up on time, and it's just, I'll be digital today this week because we got stuff going on or whatever the case might be. Because I've got some that half the week they'll be in the classroom and half the week they'll be digital.
I have one that the parents told me they'll come back home when we mandate it.
Mandate what?
That they come back?
That they come back. But until then, I'm not going to fight with my kids, so I'm going to let them stay home.
There's no way in the world anyone's going to convince me that the online education is good as in person.
No.
Nope.
It's the most ridiculous thing in the world. And I would argue that this event is putting these kids behind.
Yeah.
Or more behind. Not your kids. They're homeschooled. But a great percentage of... And I would argue that the people that are most hurt by this are minorities, low-income, single parents.
Yep.
Right. The ones that the Democratic Party claims to be the most concerned about.
And the reason for that is children, students, people of that age in life don't do things naturally without parental encouragement, which is they force them to do it most of the time.
I think about my own Bible class. I also have a Bible class, all seniors, and getting them to learn in person, Jack, is like pulling teeth. I can't even imagine what it would be like if that kid was behind a monitor in which I couldn't see eye contact, I couldn't see them falling asleep, I couldn't see them laying in bed, I couldn't see them not engaged, I can't ask them a follow-on question. You're basically totally handcuffing me in my ability to impact their learning in any way, shape, or form.
Especially trying to do both.
Can you imagine doing homeschooling and you're in one room on a monitor and your kid's in the other room on a monitor and you can have no interaction with your kid and you're going to make sure that they learn?
Yeah, it's impossible. You know, it's hard even on the college level. I've got college seminary professor friends and it's a nightmare.
Right.
It's a nightmare for them.
And that's a college student who's supposed to be wanting to learn and get this degree.
Yep.
Right. It's crazy.
Don't look over at me, Jack. I'm not doing, I am doing virtual classes.
We need in-person church. We need in-person education. We need in-person everything. That's who we are. I mean, I agree with John MacArthur. It might not be a watershed moment, but church is essential. Church is essential. And every single church in America should do everything they can to open their doors. And those who want to come back, come back. Those who don't, don't.
And I will say this. I don't agree with the... Okay, so here's what I came out from both videos and everything else. Is establish a left and right limit. Like you said earlier, emerging persecution, mild persecution, that kind of thing. Is discrimination persecution? Yes, it could be. Is hindered rights persecution? Yes, it might well be. And if you're in that mild of a level, the chances of the honesty of the political people saying, yeah, I'm motivated because I don't like Christianity to be swayed to make the decision is not going to come out in a platform speech. So yes, we could make the argument that these are persecutions, and yes, John MacArthur's church in California is suffering some form of persecution. I don't think it's Reformation level. even with that said. I just agree, Steve. I don't think so.
Of course it's not.
And it's certainly not China level, Nate. Or being thrown, being beheaded as a Muslim, or a Christian by a Muslim nation level, like our author talks about and everything else. And I understand his sensitivity, having been befriending all of those people, to not want to lose the intensity and focus on that type of persecution for a milder persecution. John, you made a good point of sending it forward and everything else. I think the what it really boils down to is, what can we do about it? In the essence of, what do we do where we're not weary and well-doing, that we keep pushing forward? How do we articulate in such a way that we take people like, okay, let's put ourselves in this situation. We're now living the book of Hebrews. We're now living 1 Peter. We're now living 2 Peter. We're living these books that were written somewhere between 60 AD and 63 AD, just before Nero's heavy persecution. We're on the cusp of it. We know that there's a growing dissatisfaction with Christians in our community. We're not comfortable with what they're bringing in. We're making it harder for them. We're making it harder for them. We're making it harder for them, so that when Nero burns Rome, it's easy for him to go. The Christians did it. People believe it. They get behind it. Heavy persecution starts. So definitely the epistles were written in that time frame, because there was a level of persecution taking place. There was these trials and tribulations and things of that nature. So how do we extrapolate that to our modern world today and say, okay, the government overreach that is taking place is a form of mild persecution. It could, if we're not careful, lead to outright severe persecution. And how do we encourage our people to deal with that and also have confidence that God is the one who determines whether or not your COVID connection is going to be severe, to the point that he may choose to heal you of COVID in eternity? Whether modern medicine has you on a ventilator or not. Because that's the challenge that we have to come out of this with and face. We can talk semantics all along, but if we're not hitting that rubber on that road and giving these people something to be encouraged by, I don't know. I mean,
well, the encouragement is that God's in control, right?
That's
the first
focus, yes.
Yeah.
And we have a living hope.
Yeah.
Right. And the reality is that for us to die is gain. But we don't really believe that.
No, we don't.
We don't believe that. And sometimes appropriately so, you know. Church member this week whose husband is in ICU, and she's frantic because at this point she can't imagine living her life without her husband. And we don't need to ridicule that, because that is exactly Genesis 2. Leave mother and father, cleave to the wife, and live in such a way that you can't imagine living without the other person.
Yeah.
But we also know that his grace is sufficient, and that God can provide for her all that she needs in to comfort her in her grief, and to find her sufficiency in him in the absence of her husband, should God call him home. And that doesn't take it and make it any easier. But it didn't make it any easier for the people who were burning at the stake. And any of you that have read like Fox's Book of Martyrs, any of his books, they'll always have some type of, we want to know, is his grace sufficient? Blink your eyes, wiggle your finger, tell us something on the, whatever the mechanism that they have. And they would have these signs that the person would give to them, and then the church would get this great encouragement that his grace is sufficient. But I promise you that didn't change the anxiety in anticipation for your next event.
Yeah.
When you were next.
No.
For the hanging, the quartering, the burning at the stake, the trip to the lion's den, and all that.
And John, certainly we don't want to go down the whole road like Bonhoeffer did and said, finally when they came for the Christians, there was no one left to be there for me. Mm-hmm. You know, in that essence.
Yeah, I mean, for every COVID case that it's easy and they're just like they had it and they recovered, I mean, you know, the president's case. That's not a reasonable example.
That's what I was saying.
Right. That's not a reasonable example. You know, and he should have said that. He missed a golden opportunity to talk to the American people and thank all the doctors and the amazing care that he got, and then speak to the fact that every American's not giving this level of care, and somehow we need to get these drugs that I received advanced, and you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's really kind of sad because I think as a leader, he missed a golden opportunity many times, but on this particular case...
Every day?
Yeah. On this particular case, I mean, he could use...
We had that debate.
...this opportunity to address the idea of death, yeah. To address the idea that, you know, you should be thankful. You live in a really secure country. You know, you should be thankful. This, no matter what narrative you believe, no matter what number you believe, you know, whether you believe the most radical leftist agenda number or whether you believe the most denying number, it's a small percentage of mortality at this point, sure. in this this pandemic, and so and talk about those things, but I mean the level to which he goes and talks about just things that don't make any impact is just mind-boggling. But the reality is, the Democrats do that too. I mean, they don't.
Everyone does that to make their point. Sure,
it's because it's all about, you know, trying to convince somebody, like Jack, you said, to get with my perception. Yep. Get with my perception. Let's not have real discussions about, you know, what is 0.000145 look like, right. Mathematically.
Right. It's not sensational.
Yeah.
You might change somebody's brain.
You talk about Pastor talking about somebody being asleep behind a monitor. Let's watch that YouTube video.
Okay, we're going to wrap this podcast up. But before we do, you're going to be preaching tomorrow night. Let's see. Brian, what time do you think we'll be live tomorrow?
Right at 7:15.
All right, so 7:15 on our Facebook channel, on our YouTube, Brian Baptist CH. We'll be live for a men's event, and we're going to sing a couple songs of worship, and then we're going to transition to some preaching. And Steve Vaughn is our guest preacher, so give us a preview. Kind of get this listener who listens to want to tune in and hear what can you be excited like that and kind of like
I can try, yeah.
Well, that was over the top right there. Yeah. Did you hear that? All right, don't run for office.
Now
okay.
Inspired, yeah. Yeah.
Tell us what you're preaching about.
2 Samuel 13. This is the story of where Amnon brutally sexually assaults his half sister, and then in the second half of the chapter, Absalom kills him for it. And so what we're going to notice, what haunts this chapter, is that David, who is both the king and the dad, does nothing. We're going to notice a severe leadership void, and we're going to talk about what David could have, should have done, and we're going to apply it to our own lives, because the need for leadership is, I think we've even noticed in this discussion today, the need for leadership is immense, and how can we bring that to bear in our areas of influence?
Yeah, and I guess since you circled back to our podcast, I think we should commend Johnny MacArthur for his effort to go to Twitter and to use video and to take mm-hmm. a leadership role in an evangelical church that does not have, we don't have a pope. We don't have an arch cardinal. We don't have someone that stands up. And MacArthur, look, the man's in the same church for 50 years, half a century. That's an inconceivable number to me, you know, that he's been pastoring and leading that church. And he's saying church is essential, open your churches. He's trying to encourage every young man. So there's clearly a vacuum of leadership in America right now, and it really starts at the home, doesn't it?
Yep. Yep, and it's gonna be a lot of application to fathers, but I think to husbands, to grandfathers, and then also just in the ways that you work, and different, because we have a lot of influence, we have a ton of influence, more than we realize,
and we're not using it.
No, we're not using it.
Yeah.
No.
Yep.
And the one of the big points I want to make is that we have to be actively trying to change the people that God has entrusted to us, right. Because they're being discipled 24/7 by morons,
And so we have to be in their ear.
So are we going to have a sanctifying effect, or are we going to have a neutral effect, or are we going to have an opposite effect? Right. Where the author of Samuel is very intentional in the absence of David. Like, where's David?
Yep.
The whole story's been about David, and suddenly we have these verse after verse after verse in which David is just missing.
Yep.
Is that an accident in the Word of God, or is the Holy Spirit writing in such a way so that we see?
He's absolutely. It's a narrative. It's a plot theme. It absolutely is. And I think one of the most. I won't have time probably to talk about it too much tomorrow, but I mean, as soon as Absalom sees his sister after she's attacked, Absalom says, "Did Amnon do this to you?" I mean, David is brilliant. David has been a brilliant strategist. He knows people. He's a brilliant man. And Absalom picks up on something right away, and David didn't pick up on it. David didn't follow this. He wasn't tracking this. He didn't know his family well enough to know that this is who Amnon was. And Absalom knew it right away. No, there's no way. There's no way. And so there's things like that in the story that tell us David, oh man, he should have been there, and he just wasn't. He was completely disengaged.
Yeah, that's an aspect of the Word of God that I've been trying to show more and more on Sunday nights. I don't know how well I'm doing on it, but if you're reading a novel and suddenly the main character disappears off the pages of the novel for two chapters, the author has a message to communicate to you.
Yep.
And we need to be seeing that that message and getting all that we can from it. So again, 7:15, about that time tomorrow night, you'll see us singing all that, and then know that we're going to have a men's retreat, our men's stakeout. This is in substitution to our annual men's retreat that we would normally have. Hopefully next year, COVID is dead, and we're back to normal down in Camp Anchorage and enjoying ourselves. So we hope you tune in. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.